Acts chapter 21 is a fascinating chapter. I don't want to necessarily reiterate everything that we talked about on Sunday, but it's crucial, at least in my judgment, to see the events as they unfold toward these latter chapters in the book of Acts. We know that the Apostle Paul is traveling on his way to Jerusalem. He has traveled up through portions of Asia and on up into Macedonia and then down to Achaia, having addressed the church at Corinth from Ephesus in Asia in the 1 Corinthian letter, and then traveling on up into Macedonia, very much concerned about the reception of that 1 Corinthian letter. He has sent Titus on ahead to see what the report or what the response to that letter has been. When he comes to Troas, Paul has an open door, but he's not able to take advantage of it out of his concern for those in Corinth. He travels then on up into Macedonia, where he finds Titus, and the report, I'm looking in 1 Thessalonians. You're right. Helps when you get in the right book. Yeah, Titus. I like to get it right every once in a while. But Titus comes in 2 Corinthians 7 and brings a very good report concerning the circumstances that exist in Corinth. And by the way, just a tangent here. When Paul wrote the 1 Thessalonian letter, he was concerned about them also. I find this fascinating. He sent Timothy over to Thessalonica. That's what I was thinking about. And Timothy comes back and has a good report about those in Thessalonica, and that's where you are in 2 Thessalonians chapter 3. But I was looking in the wrong place. In 2 Corinthians chapter 7, Titus has a very good report regarding those in Corinth, their reception of the letter. And as Paul then travels from Macedonia on down to Corinth, the intended purpose is to pick up the collection that they have for the needy saints in Jerusalem and spend some time there, and then to go on to Jerusalem and distribute those funds to the needy saints in Jerusalem. Now, going back to Acts chapter 21, I want to pick up the reading at verse 17. This is crucial now to the events as they unfold. In verse 17, let me get past this map, past this one, over to this one, yes. In verse 17, it says, "And when we were come to Jerusalem, the brethren received us gladly. And the day following, Paul went in with us unto James, and all the elders were present. And when he had saluted them, he rehearsed one by one the things which God had wrought among the Gentiles through his ministry. And they, when they heard it, glorified God and said unto him, Thou seest, brother, how many thousands there are among the Jews of them that had believed, and they are all zealous for the law." Now, that portion of the text introduces something that I want to set on the shelf and hold for just now. But I want to notice in verse 17 that when Paul came into the city of Jerusalem, it tells us that the brethren received him gladly. Now, that is such a crucial passage. Sometimes, in fact, in my early on studies, I just read right over that. Paul came to Jerusalem and the brethren received him. So what? But in view of the purpose of him coming, we know that there was some question whether or not the brethren in Jerusalem would receive him or receive the collection that he had collected among these Gentile churches. And we know that just before he came to Jerusalem, in part of his stay in Corinth, he wrote the Roman epistle. And I want you to look at what he said just prior to his taking off and coming down to Jerusalem. In Romans chapter 15, if you'll pick up the reading beginning at verse 25. Romans 15, verse 25. Paul reports, "But now I say, I go unto Jerusalem ministering unto the saints. For it hath been the good pleasure of Macedonia and Achaia to make a certain contribution for the poor among the saints that are at Jerusalem. Yea, it hath been their good pleasure, and their debtors they are. For if the Gentiles have been made partakers of their spiritual things, they owe it to them also to minister unto them in carnal things. When therefore I have accomplished this, I have sealed to them this fruit, I will go on my way by you unto Spain. And I know that when I come unto you, I shall come in the fullness of the blessings of Christ. Now I beseech you, brethren, by our Lord Jesus Christ, and by the love of the Spirit, that ye strive together with me in your prayers to God for me, that I may be delivered of them that are disobedient in Judea, and that my ministration which I have for Jerusalem may be acceptable to the saints, that I may come unto you in joy through the will of God, and to gather with you find rest. Now the God of peace be with you all. Amen. Do you see in these closing verses, as Paul is writing to those in Rome, these closing verses of the 15th chapter, he's on his way to Jerusalem. To do what? All right, to deliver these funds to the many saints that are there. In verses 30 through the end of the chapter, Paul calls upon them to pray for him. To what end? All right, that's one thing. What else?
That his service may prove acceptable to the saints.
All right, this second element is what I want to look at, that his ministration or his service may be acceptable among the saints. Why has he gone to Jerusalem? To distribute these funds that have been collected from these Gentile churches. And he calls upon these Gentile churches, Rome for example, to pray that those in Jerusalem might even receive them. Why do you suppose there would be any question?
Well, he's already been warned that he's going to be killed.
All right, that's true. His safety is a primary concern. But why is he concerned that this collection might not be received of brethren? Chris? Prejudice between Gentiles and Jews. Joey, can you imagine a circumstance existing? I saw you move your head. Can you imagine a circumstance even exist where you're hungry, you don't have the necessities of life, but you would allow your personal prejudices to just go ahead and starve to death rather than accept contribution from people that you just didn't like? That's just deplorable, isn't it? Hard to wrap our minds around that. But that's what Paul's concern is. Now you see back over in Acts chapter 21, in verse 17, how important it is then when he said, when we were come to Jerusalem, the brethren received us gladly. There are just volumes in those words. There were questions whether the brethren would receive them at all. And now the brethren receive us gladly.
Really nothing new. You can see some of those same attitudes today, you know, between the Islamic people and then the Jews in Israel over there. They think of each other as, you know, dogs and things like that. You see the same attitude today where people so despise another group that, yeah, they wouldn't, if they were on fire, they wouldn't want anybody throwing water on them.
Well, that's right. Yeah, prejudice is not a new thing. It's just not a new thing. And that's what we see here. Now, in verse 18 beginning, it says, in the day following, Paul went in with us unto James, and all the elders were present. And when he had saluted them, he rehearsed one by one the things which God had wrought among the Gentiles through his ministry. And they, when they heard it, glorified God. Now that's Paul's just there. We find the reception of these elders just right up here at the top. When Paul relates the conversion of the Gentiles, these elders are just tickled pink. Because, as we've noted in Acts chapter 11 in verse 18, that God has granted repentance unto life unto the Gentiles also. These elders get it. But they see a problem. And what's the problem? Look at verse 20 as it continues. They glorified God, and they said unto him, Thou seest, brother, how many thousands there are among the Jews of them that had believed, and they are all zealous for the law. And they have been informed concerning thee that thou teachest all the Jews who are among the Gentiles to forsake Moses, telling them not to circumcise their children, neither to walk after the customs. Now what we have on the board here, I simply want to go past it because it identifies Paul's arrival in Rome. But when we talk about his traveling to Jerusalem in these early verses prior to his arrest in Jerusalem, we note the purpose of his going, to take these funds to the needy saints in Jerusalem. We know that these funds are at least received of the elders, these brethren received them. But these elders are very much concerned about the source of a problem that not only at this time exists among them, but it has previously existed among them. What is it? All right. What we're talking about is Jews who had become Christians, upset about what the Gentiles are being taught and what they do to become Christians. Now, when we looked at the conversion of Cornelius back over in Acts chapter 10, what did Paul perceive through the vision that he saw? No respecter of persons, but in every nation, he that feareth him and worketh righteousness is acceptable unto him. Now, Peter learned that the same gospel was to be preached to Jews and Gentiles alike. Peter, in defense of these Gentiles, when he's called on the carpet in Acts chapter 11, explains the events as they have transpired in order, and we want to underscore that, because Cornelius saw an angel that told him to go down there and get Peter, and Peter saw a vision that told him, according to Acts chapter 11, verse 12, to go with these men asking no questions because there was no distinction between Jews and Gentiles. Now, when you come to Acts the 15th chapter, once again we find that the issue of circumcising Gentiles has become a divisive issue. And the thing I want to drive home just here is, we're not talking about those who are in the Jews' religion being upset with Gentiles who are becoming Christians. We're talking about Jews who are Christians upset with Gentiles who are becoming Christians. So we have Jews who are Christians binding their customs and traditions and practices of the law upon those who are Gentiles. Yes. Yes, that's correct. That's correct.
He's not teaching those who are in predominantly Gentile cities instead of Jews.
No.
In predominantly Gentile cities to forsake the law.
Yeah. You're correct. What I'm trying to do is set the stage for that very point. This difficulty, no, that's all right, this controversy between Jews and Gentiles is what prompted this objection. And in fact, I think you'll find this confrontation or accusation very premature. Was Paul teaching as these Jews who are among the brethren? Was he teaching Jews who are among the Gentiles to forsake Moses? Was he teaching anybody to forsake Moses? No. He wasn't teaching Jews who are believers in Jerusalem. He wasn't teaching Jews, believers or unbelievers, among the Gentiles. He wasn't teaching anybody to forsake Moses. In fact, if you'll notice the accusations as they continue, telling them not to circumcise their children. Had Paul ever told any Jew not to circumcise their children? No.
Well, would it have really been wrong for him to do so? Because we really are talking about the completion of the old law. It's not in effect anymore. You know, so when it comes to forsaking Moses, if that phrase means we're no longer bound by the old law, then it would not have been wrong for him to in fact, have done that teaching, right? In the sense that he would have said, that law is completed, it's finished, it's not binding anymore. No more circumcision, no more animal sacrifices, etc.
Paul had taught that, that the law is completed. In fact, we see that in Ephesians and Colossians and a host of other places. The law has served its purpose, that's right. But to teach these folks that the law is fulfilled is not equivalent to teaching them to forsake Moses.
I guess we have to define the phrase.
Yeah, sure you do. Yeah. What does that mean, to forsake Moses? Will you just discount Moses, regard him no longer as a prophet? No, Paul never taught that. He never taught that. What he had taught is what Moses said had been fulfilled. Now we've got a period of transitioning the Jews from their customs and traditions away from those things to be faithful in Christ. Now some of their customs and traditions did not violate the will of Christ. Some of the customs and traditions of the Gentiles did not violate the will of Christ. And so,
as long as they didn't try to find those.
That's right. That's right. Paul had said in 1 Corinthians chapter 9, I have become all things to all men. And he indicated in that text, to those who were without law, I became as without law. That is, to the Gentile, I behaved as best I could as a Gentile. And to those who were under the law, I behaved as one under the law. That is, to the Jew, I behaved the best I could as a Jew. In the observance of these traditions and customs, as long as I don't bind them, and as long as I don't violate the conscience of somebody else, you see, then we don't have a problem over this. But here, this was a problem. You see that, Jonathan? This was a problem. And why?
If you're propagating the false teaching that this practice is necessary for you to be right with God, now you have a problem.
You have a problem.
Circumcision or something.
Like, yeah. But on the other side of that coin, how do we disarm some of these attitudes that were prevalent during New Testament times? Paul had not taught against the law. He had not taught that they should forsake Moses, and neither had he taught them to forsake their customs. In verse 22, let's follow that thought where it leads. It said, what is it therefore? They will certainly hear that thou art come. Do therefore this that we say to thee, we have four men that have a vow on them. Take these and purify thyself with them and be at charges for them that they may shave their heads and all shall know that there is no truth in the things whereof they have been informed concerning thee, but thou thyself also walkest orderly keeping the law. Now that's just an interesting scenario. Johnny, you want to pick up on that and maybe elaborate just a little bit? What is it these elders want him to do and why? Right.
He's saying, show them that you also understand what the law is about. You have no problem with their customs.
Right.
In these senses.
Yeah. You're willing to do with them.
Jewish person, right?
Yeah.
It's nothing else against Jewishness.
Yeah. That's right. That's exactly right. And so we've got a problem here, and it can be alleviated. Pardon me? It can be alleviated. If Paul will show them, I will participate in your customs. I will go into the temple. I will participate in this custom. Some have presumed that this vow that is discussed here is the Nazarite vow. Some have suggested that these men had started and didn't finish, in which case they'd have to start all over with the procedures of the vow. Some suggest they'd never started, and so that we don't know. But nonetheless, here are certain elements of this vow that these elders call upon Paul to participate in with these Jews to disarm them.
Is this somewhat of the same attitude that Christ had, where he was seen eating with sinners, and he would come down to that level, not to participate in with them, but he would come to where the people were, not expect them to come to him?
Yes, I think there's some overlap there. I do. The circumstances, the background circumstances are not the same, but the application is essentially the same. Yes.
So, I mean, when he's talking to Jews, he tries, they can come to the Jew, but attempts not to offend the Jews. intends not to offend the Gentiles, and he's with the Gentiles in order to teach them to be friends.
Exactly right. Yeah. I'll do what I can to try to walk in your shoes as far as I can go. Now, granted, there is a limitation to that.
Right.
But at the same point, yes, there's an application there.
Well, I mean, the whole idea that Chris is referencing here, we have a phrase today that we use to try to describe this mindset, and that's when in Rome do as the Romans do.
Yeah.
And I think that's trying to encapsulate this idea of, you know, try to, you know, without violating right or wrong, or without violating law, try to meet people halfway on their turf. You know, I mean, I think that's the idea, right?
Yeah.
Now, I have a question for you about verse 24.
All right.
He says, "But you yourself also walk orderly, keeping the law." Now, I've got what's probably the New King James here, and the word law there is capitalized. If that's a reference to the old law, then do we have a verse here where someone is being encouraged to keep a law that has been abolished?
Well, let's keep in mind what the law contained. When we talk about the law of Moses, for example, what did it contain? Two elements. Well, you might even think three. When you think of the law of Moses, you think of it being a civil law. It told them how to be governed civilly and what the penalties were for violation of that law. We also note that it served the purpose of a religious law. Contained in the law was the elements of their sacrifices, the priesthood, etc., etc., etc. Contained in the law were practices relative to their customs, such as the taking of vows and
dietary rules
and the whole package. So what we want to note in that is that the law, when we refer to that, is not necessarily all-encompassing. To say now Paul's going back and keeping parts of the law and thus violating the very thing that he told the Galatians, that if you keep part of it, you're obligated to keep all of it.
But I can see where someone could very easily be confused by this, the end of verse 24 here, where it's somebody's being encouraged to keep the law, the very law that we know is now obsolete and should not be kept.
Yeah. But what part of it?
Religiously.
Yeah. All right, more on that from Hebrews 10. Yes.
I think we can see in the preaching of the gospel that what was done when the gospel was preached by essentially anybody that we see reported in the book of Acts or in the New Testament, that they preached the gospel. They didn't preach against the law. They taught how the gospel was supposed to be fulfilled. And when we look at these things that Paul observed, partially because 1 Corinthians 9:21. Or 9:20 rather, shows that 9:20 says, to them that are under the law, as under the law, not being myself under the law. So he says in 1 Corinthians that he was not under the law.
Right.
But none of these practices that he's talking about here can be categorized as sinful.
No.
Unless they're pressed upon people as religious observances.
That's right.
And so he's keeping things that are not in and of themselves sinful and okay to observe as long as you don't press them against people that they're required to do this in order to be saved. Because Paul and these same elders that he's talking to probably already wrote the letter to Antioch saying that you don't have to be circumcised and you don't essentially have to keep the law. You just have to not drink blood and stay away from things that are strangled.
Mm-hmm. Don't fornicate.
And fornication. And so what they're doing is they're positively preaching the gospel and then realizing, and we see this throughout the New Testament, that as you mentioned in the word transition, as they're transitioning from this old law to this new law, eventually they or their children will understand that not only do we not have to keep this law, but none of the things that were under the law are things that we need to be concerned about or observing.
That's right. And this was an issue that troubled not only Jews, it troubled Gentiles in their past practice of eating meat sacrificed to idols. and there's an element of knowledge over here, and then there's the element of ignorance over here, then we're learning. And when we learn, then we're going to separate ourselves from that previous understanding. And we all do that.
Well, if you, and just to push that point on the Gentile part, is that when Paul's talking about his experiences in Athens, and he says that you go to the marketplace to buy meat, and it says, you know, a big sign up here says this thing was sacrificed to the idol. You don't buy it because of your own conscience, but for the conscience of the guy that's there that's thinking, you're buying this because you know it's been sacrificed to the idol.
Yeah.
It's him you're trying to teach. You don't go up to him and say, you're wrong for selling this meat. You just don't buy it yourself because you know that he'll think that you're buying it because it was sacrificed to an idol.
Yeah.
So you have an opportunity to teach the gospel as opposed to teaching against
things that are indifferent.
Right.
Yeah. And that's key. I have yet, well, let me say it this way. I have found only very few times when someone who held to a traditional belief, and as we discussed Romans 14 and the weaker brother, the things that are done, that fellow seeing himself as the weaker brother, he sees himself as the stronger brother. But Paul identifies in 1 Corinthians 8, 1 Corinthians 10, that we know, he's speaking by inspiration, we know that the idol is nothing. We know that the eating of the meat sacrificed to the idol is nothing. We know that. But there were some that didn't have that knowledge. Now, those who didn't have that knowledge, you think you could ever get them to admit it? That they were weak or ignorant? But what do? You, as much as possible, accommodate their convictions till you can teach them. All right? Now, this is exactly what's being illustrated here in Acts chapter 21. Here was a tradition or a custom. These men had this vow. And whatever stage of development they were in this vow, I don't know. But what I do know is that these elders suggest to Paul, you go into the temple with them and you pay for those things necessary for the fulfillment of their vow. And then when you come out at the end of 7 days, the time is fulfilled. When you come out, everybody see you come out with these men and they'll know why you've been in there. And then they will know that the charges that have been brought against you are false. You're not teaching against the law. You're not teaching against the customs of Moses. Randy?
Just noting that beginning of verse 20, there's a quote. Quotation. It doesn't end until 25. So I mean, it says they heard it and said to them, so whether it was one or many,
yeah,
said this to them. But in verse 25, is that a direct reference to what happened in Acts 15?
I think so. Yes, it's quoted.
But what was the point of them telling him that? Because they sent him, or they sent Silas and what was the other one?
Was it Justice? That don't sound right. Look over in Acts 15.
Judas.
There we go.
I almost said that. Sent Judas and Silas.
Yeah. Okay.
With that message.
Yeah.
But that was sent to
Gentile churches.
Gentile churches.
Yeah.
So what was the point of them telling Paul this?
Well, Paul has just come back from Gentile churches,
right.
And
he knows is what I'm saying. He already knew.
Well, he already knew it. That's true. But they're just making a contrast here. You're not teaching the Jews who have become Christians not to keep the law in terms of these customs and practices. But what you did do is you taught the Gentiles not to engage in idolatrous practices. That's all there is to that, I think. I don't think that we need to make more of it. And in fact, in verse 26, it says, then Paul took the men and the next day, purifying himself with them, went in into the temple, declaring the fulfillment of the days of purification until the offering was offered for every one of them. Now, you'd like to think that this is the end of the matter.
That part, for me anyway, is a little surprising, verse 26. Yes, Paul is not preaching, he's not teaching against the customs. Here, though, in verse 26, he literally participates in it.
Yes.
And you might think that Paul would have said, I'm not going to participate in that because that's irrelevant because we now live in a new era. That this is the new law. None of that stuff is relevant anymore. You'd think that he might have said that, but he didn't.
No.
He actually participates with them, and I'm assuming for the purpose of, like you said, maintaining the rapport with them so that he can teach them. I assume that was the purpose that he actually participated.
I'm certain that's the case.
It's a little surprising to me that he participated and didn't use that as an opportunity to teach them that those things are old and irrelevant and done away with, so let's not do that.
You know, Joey, let me elaborate on that just a little bit. A few years ago, in fact, several years ago, when I lived in Arkansas, there was a man that I was teaching, and he was baptized into Christ. A few months later, he came to me, and he said, you know, Mick, I just don't understand why we don't use instruments of music in our worship. He said, I don't do it. I'm not advocating that we do, and I've not talked to anybody to encourage them to. He said, I just don't understand why we don't. Well, now, it wasn't as if we hadn't discussed it. He just had not been convinced. Now, I related that story to somebody and told them that in process of time, we just were patient with the man and continued to try to teach. And one day he came out of the church building and I had not preached on instrumental music. In fact, I don't think I'd even preached on worship. And he said, Mick, you said something today that opened up the door for me. He said, I know now why we don't use instruments of music in worship. I told that story to a fellow one time, and he said, well, you ought to have told him that if he didn't understand why we don't use instruments of music in worship, then we just ought to withdraw from you, and you're not a member here. You can see the hammer fall.
Yeah.
Well, now, what would you do with that fellow?
That's a lack of tact.
Well, sure, it's not only a lack of tact, but where do you suppose that fellow would be if we'd done that?
You'd probably never seen him.
Now, was he engaging in sinful practices? No. Was he advocating that I engage in sinful practices? No. He just had a lack of understanding that needed to be clarified.
Right.
Now here we're talking about something that is innocent. An innocent practice. It is something that is a custom.
Right.
Now Paul can reject the wisdom of these elders, but I think coupled with their wisdom, you see the wisdom of this inspired man. I'm going to participate in this custom. And I want to underscore a word that I've used before, to disarm them. What were the accusations? He's teaching against Moses. He's teaching against the practices of the law. He's teaching against the custom. Well, he wasn't doing that. He was not doing that. Now, how better to prove that?
In verse 26, he demonstrates that he's not teaching.
That's right. How better to prove that than for these folks to see you doing the very thing? Now, let me illustrate one more time. There was a fellow that used to worship here several years ago, or a few years ago, and he got really upset with me, just really upset. And his reasoning was, he said, you folks just don't believe in associating together. You don't believe in eating together. Now, most of you have known me for some time. And you know what I preach, that it's not the work of the church to provide social and recreational activities. But now this man, he had been to my house. He had associated with a bunch of Christians in my house. His wife had brought a dessert to my table. And then for him to sit there and tell me, you don't believe in eating together. You don't believe in associating together. How wrong can that be? Now he went into an environment where the work of the church was just far out there because this is what he wanted. He wanted it to be the work of the church to do those things. And when he was told, you know, those folks don't believe in eating together. He just joined right in with them. Now, what help he have presented? No, that's not so, because I've seen them do it. I participated with them. That's just not so. Now, you see what Paul's doing? Quite the contrary to what that man did. He just was dishonest. But what we see Paul doing in this passage is, in all honesty, disarming these accusations by participating in those customs. So who now can believe that Paul is teaching against the very thing he's doing? You see, he'd be a hypocrite of all hypocrites if he did.
Stringer, in his commentary on the book of Acts, has an interesting quote here. Or statement here. He says, Paul made a clear distinction between observing the precepts of the law of Moses due to the belief that they were necessary for salvation and observing them as a national custom, a part of the Jews' heritage.
Yeah.
And that's what we've said all along, is that, and once again, we have to observe that these things are not sinful.
Right. But we often do this. I mean, when we look at different cultures, we can look at different cultures right here in the United States. We don't have to go abroad. We look at different cultures, and we see an application of that. In the South, there are things that are done and tolerated that you bring that out here. People say, I don't understand why you're doing that. Or you can take things from here and go back to the South, and folks in the South tell you, I don't know why you don't do this. I don't know why you haven't done this all. We've done this all my life. Why do you have a problem with that? All right, John?
But also, it's interesting because it comes from the elders, and their job is to watch out for the spiritual well-being of all of their people that they're overseeing. In 2020, it says, and when they heard it, they began to glorify God. You see, brother, how many thousands there are among the Jews of those who have believed, and they're all zealous for the law. So they had, this option of having them do this and basically disarm them. Or they can pull together these thousands of Jews and have a big meeting, and they're all zealous for the law, and he can try to explain himself. And I'm sure that he could spend months on whatever speech. I'm sure we all know how well that would go with thousands of people.
Yes. Yes.
And the truth is, people will talk. And that probably spread like that.
You know, it's interesting to me to note that a lie often spreads farther and faster than the truth. Randy?
You have to believe me when I say I don't want to stir the pot.
Uh-oh. Moving right along.
But Jesus did tell us not to take vows. In Matthew chapter 5, beginning verse 33, again, you have heard the ancients were told, you shall not make false vows, but fulfill your vows to the Lord. But I say to you, make no oath at all, either by heaven, for it is the throne of God, or by earth, for it is the footstool of his feet, or by Jerusalem, for it is the city of the great king. Nor shall you make an oath by your head, for you cannot make one hair white or black, but let your statement be yes, yes, or no, no, anything beyond this is an evil.
Yeah. When did Jesus say that?
During the Sermon on the Mount.
Yes, and what law was in practice at the time?
Mosaic law,
of which the Nazarite vow was a part, which I find interesting. We got Jesus against Moses. Now, what we're looking at is a custom that the law addressed. Now, you're right, but we have to examine context. The context of the Sermon on the Mount is, here were some who were saying and not doing. Don't make false vows. Yeah. Let your yea be yea. Of course, I understand that the Jews were in the habit of, as you'll notice in that text, they swear by the temple and say, well, I don't have to do that because, you see, I didn't swear by heaven. So their vows didn't mean anything. Their vows were false. And what Jesus is saying in that context is, let your word be your bond. You say you'll do it, then do it.
Tell the truth.
Yeah. James?
I think later on in Matthew, was it 22 or 23, when Jesus called them hypocrites?
23, yes.
Yeah, and that's what he was getting at. But I think it's also interesting to notice that in the book of Hebrews it says that God swore by himself because he could swear by no one greater. So God even took an oath or a vow with himself. And when you look up the definitions of the word, and I did it years ago, the word vow or the word oath or swear by, they all the same. It's like faith and belief. They basically boil down to the same thing.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a promise that you bind yourself by. Yeah.
Now, you've got a credibility issue.
Yeah.
When you have an outsider coming in telling you you guys are doing things wrong, no matter how tactful he is, he's got to have some kind of credibility to him for those people to accept him. That's why Jesus said a prophet is not without honor except in his own country, because we know you, we know who you are. But when he goes somewhere else and says that, did what he did and said the things he said, it had a different impact because these weren't the people who saw him from a wee little boy up.
True.
So Paul is trying to make sure that he and these men with him are seen as credible by doing things that are not sinful, but just simple custom, so that it won't hinder his work. Now, unfortunately, later on, false accusations are made about this thing that caused all kinds of trouble. But the point here is, and what Paul was trying to do was to make sure that nothing would hinder his work, nothing would hinder the gospel going out.
That's right, and I want to use what you said as a springboard. Later on, and it's not much later, all kinds of accusations are made. Let's pick up the reading, if you would, beginning at verse 27. Now we've got Paul going into the temple during the engaged with these men in the days of purification. And then in verse 27 it says, "And when the 7 days were almost completed, the Jews from Asia, when they saw him in the temple, stirred up all the multitude and laid hands on him, crying out, 'Men of Israel, help! This is the man that teacheth all men everywhere, against the people and the law and this place. And moreover, he brought Greeks also into the temple and hath defiled this holy place.'" Now, I don't know what the evidence supports or does not support regarding these Jews from Asia. Some have supposed that these were Jews who were very devout in the Jews' religion. They had not become Christians. Others perhaps would suppose that these are Jews who are Christians who are going from place to place trying to stir up trouble from Paul or for Paul. Now, you can lean either way on that. It doesn't change the point. But what we find here is that there are many, the term used in, what verse is it, thousands? Verse 20, yes, thousands. I think there's a footnote on that in some translations. Myriads or 10,000s, yes. But the idea, we've got a multitude of people here in Jerusalem among Christians that have a problem with you, Paul, based on what they've heard. So you do this and it will dispel their fears. Now here you have, it don't take a whole lot of folks to fan a flame, does it? Here you have these Jews coming down from Asia, and they're telling already these Jews in Jerusalem, these who had become Christians, that what you said is absolutely right. We've been up there, we've witnessed Paul preaching that all over the place. James?
When you read this and you listen to the way it sounds, it's very prejudicial. It's trumped up charges.
Well, sure it is.
Plain and simple.
But you know, you can take people...
I find it interesting, though, that even though the charges are trumped up, and Paul knows it, and these guys with him know it, they're still going to make sure that they're doing all things honorable in the sight of these men. They're going to clear the air.
Well, that's right.
They're not guilty of anything.
But you know, the thing that fascinates me is you can take people who are upset and want to be upset, and it don't take very many or very much to push them.
But believe what you want to believe if you're bent in that direction.
Yeah. Now, we have to be careful of that, lest we be that small crowd that's prodding, or whether we be in the large crowd that's prodded to accept and believe something without evidence.
I was going to point out that verse 29 explains what they, they were upset. They saw him with Trophimus the Ephesian, and they supposed that he brought him to the temple.
Yeah.
He was obviously a traveling companion of his.
Yeah, he was from Ephesus.
Recognized he was not a Jew, and they assumed he had taken him.
Yeah. Well, that's a good way to prove your point, isn't it? Yeah. You take something that looks that way, whether you know it is or not, and you say that it is that way.
He obviously hangs out with Gentiles.
Well, sure he does.
He obviously took one in.
Absolutely, because we saw him come to town with one. Now, don't we do the same thing? You ever find yourself guilty of being so foolish? Now, that's just exactly what it is. It's just foolishness. But you see, all you have to have is something that looks like evidence when you want to whip up a people. It don't have to be genuine. Yeah.
That's not new.
No, it's not new. All you have to do is accuse. And one of the things that we see here, and we want to see as these chapters develop, is that what Paul presents to the people is evidence, not rumors. Randy and Joey.
This was just a very strange time. You could see the Jews, as long as that temple had been there, rebuilt, had been considering it to be holy and a Jewish thing.
Yeah.
And it's interesting that they had no idea how fast that was going to come down.
Well, no, they didn't. But you can see the calls for their alarm. You know, this is a part of our heritage for 1,500 years. You know, our grandma and grandpa and great-grandpa and grandpa, they all came here. And so, yeah, if he's teaching against that, and certainly if he defiled it, he's a bad fella. Joey?
It's difficult for a lot of people to remain unbiased and impartial and open-minded. People quite often see what they want to see and hear what they want to hear.
Well, that's right. Of course, Randy has injected into the discussion verse 29. Verse 28 tells us the accusation simply repeated. But in verse 29, the reason, we saw Trophimus, the Ephesian, and we think Paul took him into the temple. We've supposed
people,
that that's
yeah,
so.
People see what they want to see.
Sure. Now look at verse 30. And all the city was moved. And the people ran together, and they laid hold on Paul and dragged him out of the temple. And straightway the doors were shut. You see, we're not going to let Paul go back in there. No more evidence is going to be accumulated. This is what we've seen. This is what we've said. Therefore, this is what must be so. Now, if you look at verse 31, and as they were seeking to kill him, tidings came up to the chief captain of the band that all Jerusalem was in confusion. Now, what happened to the advice of these elders? Was it wise?
It didn't work.
It didn't work, but there wasn't much alternative, was
it? It seemed like it makes sense to God.
Okay. But it didn't work, and why? It's tough to undermine a lie, isn't it? You know, if you've got the truth, and here are 10 fellows over here that have a lie, and they tell the lie, and you've got the truth, who's going to be believed? It's going to take some real powerful convincing to convince folks that these 10 people lied. Now, that's where we are in this. In verse 31, it tells us they were seeking to kill him, and tidings came to the chief captain of the band that all Jerusalem was in confusion. Now, this chief captain has a name. What's his name?
Claudius Lysias.
Yes, I have trouble remembering that. Claudius Lysias. We see him coming to the rescue of Paul a number of times. But let's remember that in this context of Acts chapter 21, we see the beginning or the development of the thing that Paul had been warned about several times. I have a chart on that back somewhere. Well, maybe I got one up front somewhere. Yes, Acts 20, 22 through 23, Acts 21, verse 4, Acts 21, beginning in verse 11 with the words of Agabus. Paul's been told a number of times, you go to Jerusalem, it's not going to be good. And what's Paul's attitude about that? Got to go anyway. If they kill me, so be it. And what is it that he soon finds they want to do? They want to kill him. They want to kill him. So the very things that have been foretold are now coming to pass. Now, does Paul know that he's not going to be killed in Jerusalem?
We'll never know.
Yes, we will. Yes, he knew that because he had been told you're going to Rome. And so we'll pick up with that Sunday and move on a little further.